I'm very excited about our next panel. As a former FAC rep, longtime FAC rep myself, with a lot of questions about our medicals and things, and the answers I just didn't have. So I'm really excited to bring on to the stage our three panelists to discuss our medical. And let me start with your Executive Vice President, Andrew Lebovich, Federal Air Surgeon, Dr. Susan Northrup, and President and CEO of AMAS, Dr. Quay Snyder.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
So, good morning again, sisters and brothers. Great honor today to facilitate this discussion from the main stage here at Communicating for Safety. As we talked about yesterday, it's the first time that we've had the opportunity to do this type of conversation at an aviation safety event for us. You know, certainly our medical certifications and the current state of aeromedical environments is important as it pertains to our members. As we were sort of constructing this conversation, there's so much that is in the medical world, it's hard to really distill that down into a concise and succinct, short stage time. So we came up with the concept of barriers. And when we talk about barriers, there's really three barriers that are sort of at the heart of most of our medical issues, in part or in whole, conscious or subconscious. And those are the ideas of fear, embarrassment, and ignorance. Fear. No one wants to lose their medical. No one wants to lose their livelihood or the ability to provide for their families. Embarrassment. No one wants to be seen as less. No one wants to be seen as weak. Stigma is real and it's significant. In ignorance. No one really truly has the knowledge to understand how the processes may occur. We rely on information and innuendo and rumor that's passed down from peer to peer without really having accuracy. So today we wanted to sort of take an opportunity to maybe try and address some of those barriers and how can we educate ourselves and overcome them. We've been talking about for the last 3 days building trust, building relationships. So when you try to establish a relationship, it has to be more than a title. It has to be more than a nebulous person somewhere in the bowels of the FAA or in NATCA, wherever it may be. So I've had the opportunity to work with Drs. Northrup and Dr. Snyder for quite a while. So I wanted to give a little bit more thorough of an introduction so you have an understanding of who is involved in the medical arena as it comes to us. So Dr. Northrup is a board certified in both aerospace medicine and occupational medicine. She served in the United States Air Force active duty from 1990 to 2001 and as a reservist from 2001 to 2010. She retired as a colonel. She was a regional medical director for air crew and passenger health services for Delta Airlines from 2001 to 2005 and a medical consultant for the National Pilots Association from 2005 to 2007. Dr. Northrup joined the FAA in April of 2007 as a Southern Regional Flight Surgeon, and she was quickly awarded the FAA's Flight Surgeon of the Year Award in 2008. She was selected as the Senior Regional Flight Surgeon with operational responsibilities for the entire nation, and then in January 2021, in the heart of the COVID pandemic, she was selected as the FAA's Federal Air Surgeon, where she is responsible for all aerospace medicine efforts within the FAA, including Airman Medical Certification, Air Traffic Control Health Program, AME Designee Management, internal and external substance abuse testing, and aeromedical research. In addition to these responsibilities, she served as president of the American Society for Aerospace Medicine Specialists, Civil Aviation Medical Association, and the Aerospace Medicine, and she is on the adjunct faculty for the United States Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine. Dr. Northrup has been instrumental in forging new relationships across a spectrum of aviation industries, and we're very, very grateful to have her here today. Welcome, Dr. Northrup.
Thank you.
Our second guest today is Dr. Quay Snyder, who many of you may already be familiar with as he has had close ties with NATCA for many years. Dr. Snyder is President and CEO of the Aviation Medicine Advisory Service, also known as the Virtual Flight Surgeons, providing medical certification and aviation safety guidance for pilot unions and, more relevant for today, for NACA members. Dr. Snyder has been with the Airline Pilots Association International as an aeromedical advisor since 1994, and he's been assisting NACA members since 2003, so that makes this his 20th year that we've been working together. Quay holds board certifications in aerospace medicine, addiction medicine, family practice, and occupational medicine, and has also served in the United States Air Force, the Air Force Reserve, and the Colorado Air National Guard for 25 years as a flight surgeon, glider instructor pilot, and in leadership roles. Dr. Snyder is active in many aviation safety committees and organizations, both nationally and internationally. He is an Aerospace Medicine Association Fellow, amongst other professional roles, and served on the medical expert group for the FAA's Pilot Fitness Aviation Rulemaking Committee, and he co-chairs ASMA's Pilot Mental Health Working Group. He also serves on ICAO working groups, including problematic use of psychoactive substances and mental health. He has been an invaluable resource for NACA, and again, I thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Andrew.
So let's start a conversation about medicine and our medicals. One of the things that has been a topic of conversation throughout previous panels has been the concept of a safety culture. So I'd like to pose to both of you, and I'll start with you, Dr. Northrup, how do you see aeromedical issues in the context of a safety culture?
Thank you. So, as I try to cough. So I view fitness as a spectrum. Wow, I couldn't have timed that better. at any rate, so there's a performance spectrum. There's well, there's doing great. There's stressed. And some stressed is good. Some stress makes us respond, makes us react. And then there's illness and injury. And the trick is, how do we keep you over here in the fit or responding to stress? Because let's face it, physical and mental health is part of performance and safety. It's integral. You may not think about yourselves as athletes because you're not on the football gridiron, but you are athletes with your brains. Every time you sit down at a scope or talking to a pilot, you're making critical decisions. And we owe it to you in the safety culture to make sure you have all the tools and the techniques and the medical fitness to be 100%. So my job is to help give you those tools within the FAA.
Sounds good. Dr. Snyder, I'd like to hear your perspective as well on the concept of safety culture.
Well, safety culture is absolutely critical because, as Susan said, we are mental athletes, as well as considering our physical fitness. But unlike most aviation safety systems, equipment, et cetera, which fails in a dichotomous way, either it's working or it's not working, red light, green light, and the failure rate when we design systems and safety management system, safety, when we design equipment is 1 to 10 to the minus 7th is the number we use. The most likely component, however, to fail in a safety system is not the equipment, but the human. And the human can fail in subtle ways. We're, as Susan said, we're on a spectrum all the time, so we don't get a red light or a green light. We need to figure out where we are on that spectrum and optimize our fitness, our mental fitness, perhaps even our physical fitness, to be there. And until we incorporate and ideally be able to quantify in some way where we are mentally, as far as our fitness to do our duty, it becomes difficult to really assess that. So one of the things that I focus on, Andrew, is to try to incorporate mental wellness into a safety management system to address the most likely component to fail in a subtle way or to not perform optimally in a subtle way. And in doing that, enhance the safety of the system. But to do that, we need to have a safety culture, a positive safety culture, where people feel empowered to come forward, ask for help, to admit to issues. And the three things that you talked about at the beginning, the fear, the intimidation, the barriers that we have are important in reducing so that we can make the entire system perform better.
So to that end, for people to feel more comfortable, I think the underlying component becomes trust, right? There has to be a trust between the certificate holder, the regulator, and to be able to have that level of interaction that promotes, you know, a more accurate assessment of what's going on. Have you, either one of you, seen a change in the manner in which there is a developing trust between the certificate holder and the regulator, and for that matter, between the unions and those who represent certificate holders and the regulators? I'll start with you, Sores.
With?
Sure. You.
Me. Okay. All right. So one of the things that I think we have to do in order to gain trust is to be transparent in our decision processes. So when I became the Federal Air Surgeon, we had five different documents that we looked at when it came to determining the medical disposition of air traffic controllers and pilots. And I challenged my people to get one. I want one. And we're almost done. It's called the One Guide. Right now it's internal, but my ultimate goal is to link it to the Guide for Aviation Medical Examiners. How many of you have heard about or gone to look at the Guide for Aviation Medical Examiners? I see a couple. It's outward facing. And in the last couple of years, we've modified that document so that it includes procedures for air traffic controllers. It is available online, Google AME Guide. And it's essentially a cookbook for AMEs that you can go look at. And if you're dealing with an issue, you can print the pages. Don't print the whole thing, it's 800 pages. Search for what you need. And you can take that to your treating providers and say, this is what the FAA is going to expect for about 90% of the conditions that are out there. We're working on the other 10. But ultimately, I want all of you to be as educated on what we expect as we are. Now, it's going to be a bit of tough. Now, I'll also put in there, Quay mentioned SMS. Some of my predecessors stiff-armed SMS in the air medical determination arena because there's an art to medicine. We've turned that around. We're actually looking at all the research to see if we can go to risk-based, science-based decision-making. They'll still be an art because humans are not linear like machines. So there's a bunch of things in place that we're doing that.
So that's actually an interesting point. I think you made a comment before about the binary nature of fit versus not fit, sort of a pathological approach to medicine. Do you see us moving into the future where that type of assessment is not really and a standard that we should apply anymore to utilize more of a risk-based assessment?
We're headed that way. Okay. We're headed that way because we're individuals.
Right. Right. And Quay, for you, sort of going back to the developing of trust, you've been working with us for 20 years and with pilots for longer. Are you seeing a change in the levels of trust that are being engendered across the aviation industry between the workforce?
Absolutely, and I see a global effort to engender trust between the regulators, the employees, the employer, et cetera. It really started probably 20 years ago when there were fairly tense relationships between NATCA and the FAA, and we started working collaboratively to amend the medical standards in 3933A, and that was a wonderful collaborative effort, and I think that started to increase the communications, and with the increase in communications, the trust. Susan's not going to take credit for this, but she has made a tremendous effort in what you call omnidirectional communication, and there has been a constant exchange of information between all the important stakeholders with an open ear from the FAA Office of Aerospace Medicine to do that. Also, what we're seeing are efforts across the globe in peer support, recognizing that one of the barriers to reaching out for help, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, was that people fear losing their medical qualification and their livelihood that goes with it. And pilots and air traffic controllers, we identify as these individuals. And if you take that away from us, that really undermines our mental health. So what we found throughout certainly the aviation industry, but all industries, having a peer support program will resolve about 80% of issues that come up just by the ability to reach out to someone who's not a threat to certification or continue breaking through those barriers, and talking with a peer will resolve those problems. If there's an escalation protocol, having a safety net that is consistent with a safety management system will allow people to get help they need, the safety of the system to be maintained if they're not qualified, and then ideally returned. And the FAA has really outlined, Susan and her staff has outlined paths to return to get qualification. As opposed to, you mentioned the pathogenic approach, you have a diagnosis, you're disqualified. We're looking at what's called the salutogenic approach right now, where we're looking at health and trying to optimize health. Just like you go to the gym and work out for your physical fitness and you eat right and you sleep right, you do all these things for your mental health as well. And by addressing the person proactively, then we're able to keep the person certified, but optimize the safety of the system.
So you raise actually a few points that I think we can explore a little bit further. One, stepping back to the evolution of the medical standards. Certainly, you know, a lot of the medical requirements that we see in the system right now are sort of based on, you know, very early 1900s military type regulations. And maybe for you, Susan, how have you seen some of our medical requirements or standards evolve over time? And we'll follow up afterwards with another question.
So yeah, many of our standards and regulations were based on military standards starting back in the 20s and 30s. And they were largely based on expert opinion in the arena of really not understanding all of human performance and what goes into that. In an era where the actual medical intervention was not as robust, shall we say, as it is now. There have been incredible advances in science, even since I went to medical school, where if you got a stage 3 or stage 4 cancer diagnosis, you were going to be dead in a year. And now these people are living 20, 30 years. Unfortunately, well, that's probably not the right word, but quite frankly, it's really easy to say no. And that's where a lot of these standards were based. If you want to absolutely protect the safety 100% of the time, you don't let people fly. Well, that's not the right answer. That's not where we need to be. So where do you put that bar? And getting to yes, to return somebody to controlling status or returning a pilot to the air, can be a real challenge because you're making an assessment of what's the current science, what are the side effects of the treatment, how is this person going to succeed through the system, and what are the potential failures? But we are applying science. As I said earlier, you can find in the AME guide both the ATC requirements and the pilot requirements. And as we're moving that way, we're exploring options for air traffic controllers. So you all were a bit late coming to the depression treatment programs, the SSRIs. But you're there, yay, because you deserve to be treated if somebody has a condition. And as we were looking at that, we stepped out and the requirements were really, really hard initially. And we required annual neuropsych testing. So everybody had to go back and take the battery of tests again. Well, I challenged my folks and I said, so did the neuropsych test after the first year make a difference in the final aeromedical determination? They looked at 452 individuals and determined, in the absence of clinical findings, the neuropsych testing, which ran about $2,000 to $3,000, not covered by insurance, didn't make a difference. So we got rid of it.
And we're doing the same sort of thing. Now, for those of you that are, or if you know somebody in the SSRI program, great, we added Wellbutrin in May, which was a huge step. So we have our first non-SSRI approved, and we're looking at five other medications. So we do that with about every diagnosis we can think of. ADHD, which is a huge thing. You might have heard of ADD and ADHD being separate. They've combined them into one diagnosis code at this point. But we have a fast track for certain individuals now. So fingers crossed, and we'll watch how that performs.
And I think that's very, very encouraging, because many of the questions that we receive are, you know, have the standards changed? Are there more opportunities to obtain care and be properly treated for conditions? And then how is that going to have an interaction with their certification? So it's very exciting to see or hear that those types of exploratory activities are occurring. So Quay, I want to go back to one of the other things you mentioned, which was peer support. Mm-hmm. It's a new concept for us, certainly in the air traffic system. And perhaps you could elaborate a little bit on what a peer support program is as it's being utilized in other segments of the aviation industry.
Sure. Just looking at the demographics, about 20% of people annually across the globe will meet the diagnostic criteria for some sort of mental health condition. Lifetime, it's about a 50% instance. That's higher than a lot of cancers and things like that, but it's something we've ignored. But unlike other conditions, mental health areas are amenable to treatment with peers. And so a peer support network is a group of trained volunteers who are vetted, have initial training and recurrent training to be able to have those skills, the active listening skills, to assist another individual who's in your same career, air traffic controller, pilot. It's very well developed in the pilot community right now, just to talk. One of the challenges for a peer support system, and both pilots and air traffic controllers are very independent people who solve problems. It's very difficult in the role of a peer, just sit back and listen and not offer a solution. But that's the key to making this work. Many of the problems can be resolved in one or two phone calls. It doesn't have to be face-to-face, but the active listening is important. Some take a little bit longer and may go over a couple of months, but still get the issue resolved. Say, struggling with a sick child or going through a difficult divorce, something like that. But also the peer support networks have an escalation protocol so that if the magnitude of the problem exceeds the comfort level of either the individual requesting the help or the individual peer who's assigned, that they can go to a higher level of mental health professional that can provide them the counseling if that's what is required, or in some relatively rare cases, medication, that or some sort of combination. But that assures that the individual is getting attention, that we've reduced the barriers, and that the safety of the system is improved there. And it's really getting a lot of traction around the world right now. Susan and I are going to conferences in Europe. We went to one in Singapore. EASA is publishing a study about mental health and the importance of peer support and what they call their Me Safe initiative. So it really has a lot of traction right now to remove those barriers and address the salutogenic approach toward medicine rather than the pathologic approach.
And having seen now some of that energy across the globe, and perhaps Susan, you can give some perspective from the regulator side to these peer support programs. Do you see them as being effective mechanisms to be able to have better success in caring for the workforce?
I do. Yeah, my office is a huge supporter of peer support programs. Yep. Part of the thing that we see when you talk about the stigma and the resistance and the worry is people delay care. When we could give them the tools early on when it's a little issue so that they can begin to exercise different approaches to what's going on and hopefully nip it before it becomes even a diagnosed issue
or if it is diagnosed, when it's mild to moderate, because we can handle the mild to moderate pretty easily. We know how that works. Once it gets to severe recurrent, or God forbid, an active action taken by the individual to relieve the pain, that's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to get people back there. So getting the mild to moderate, changing the paradigm around the water cooler that, oh, don't ever talk about mental health because you might get a diagnosis and you'll never control or fly again, is wrong. We've got to interfere up here. And we've actually worked very hard to get peer support initiatives down into the aviation universities and grassroots level so that the tools are there to respond to the stress.
If I could follow up
absolutely
on that too, I think that it's critical. We have one of your sponsors here is University of North Dakota, and they have a very active program. So what I see is removing the barriers of a reporting requirement that is perceived as jeopardizing your medical qualification is now being taught at the initial level of training. So our folks at UND and other universities that we've gone out to speak with are starting to standardize the idea that mental wellness is a critical part of an aviation safety management system, and the young people who are coming up seem to be much more open to discussing these problems, to serving as peers. It's just wonderful to see. So I think the next generation, the stigma will be substantially reduced, yeah, and the capabilities increased.
And I think we are seeing that, you know, just even in society writ large, coming out of the pandemic, the topic of mental health and is becoming much more prevalent and more accepted to talk about. We're winding down, and I think this is probably a good opportunity to sort of wrap things up. I do want to thank you both for being here. And just sort of to say, you know, based on a lot of the conversations that are here on stage, but are ongoing, continuing behind the scenes, you know, from an ideal perspective, it would be great to establish a trust-based relationship where the regulator trusts the certificate holder will be open and honest, you know, the disclosure of symptoms and would comply with any necessary level of care. And I think conversely, the certificate holder trusts that the regulator will not intervene unless, you know, there's a clear hazard to safety or, you know, non-compliance with care or treatment. You know, having these conversations, and I said this yesterday, it's a necessary component of establishing the trust between regulator and certificate holder, and it has to be a conversation that we continue on an ongoing basis. We absolutely have to continue to bring issues involving our health and well-being to the fore to have these conversations, because I know collectively we have an opportunity to lead on this issue, right? And I think we have an obligation to collaboratively engage and to develop some solutions for the future workforce. So again, I thank you both on behalf of NACA for sitting here and having an initial conversation. Hopefully we'll be able to see everybody again soon. So thank you so much.
Thank you.